Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Rick Kogan in today's Chicago Tribune, and a story headlined, it's the 20th anniversary of Columbine. A survivor of that school is of that school shooting is now a filmmaker, and you can see her We Are Columbine at the Music Box. Kogan began his story this way, and I read this sentence at the beginning of an interview earlier today to Laura Farber, the maker of the film. He wrote, "Talking heads, those familiar and often dreary elements of documentary films, have rarely been as powerfully honest and emotionally potent as they are in a spectacular new film that takes us all back to the bloody April 20th day in 1991, when 12 students and one teacher were slaughtered inside a Littleton, Colorado high school. That incident has been made into a documentary film that premieres tonight at 7 o'clock at the Music Box Theater here in Chicago. Just before the show, I talked to the film's maker, Laura Farber." You were in the school that day, right?
Yeah, I was. I was in the cafeteria.
What year in school were you then?
I was a freshman, a baby.
I wondered at times if there was a certain sense of ownership's not the right word, but was it more impactful to, say, seniors, do you think, than juniors, and juniors more than sophomores, and so on? Or did everybody at the school come away with the same sense and feeling?
I'm sure it was different for every class. You know, as a freshman, I just remember feeling, you know, like not being able to comprehend what had just happened. So it was just a different perspective. And then, you know, we were also the youngest, and then they're the longest.
I don't know where exactly to start, if we should walk through that day or if we should walk through the film process. You eventually left Colorado. You came to Chicago. You studied documentary filmmaking, and then you went back to Colorado to make the movie about Columbine.
Correct.
Yeah. What was that day like for you then? Do you mind walking us through what your experience was?
The day of the 20th, oddly enough, it's very similar to Amy's experience in the film. We were in the cafeteria eating lunch like a normal day. I knew I had a test later that day. I mean, I think we were there for maybe 10 minutes. And then a janitor came running down the cafeteria hallway and yelled, "Everyone get under the tables." And we got under the tables. I mean, not knowing, you know, you just sort of listen to authority, I guess, at that point. We just did it. I remember someone grabbing their nachos and bringing them under the table to eat. Couldn't tell you how long we were down there. And then all of a sudden, everyone just started running out the doors. I was probably the table closest to one of the exit doors to the school parking lot. Ran down the hill to a residential street and knocked on doors. There were about 20 of us just knocking on doors, trying to get in somewhere to get safe. And then finally someone led us into their house, and we piled in there, turned on the news. And that's when we started hearing, you know, what I thought, you know, it was bombs, but gunshots. We stayed away from the window. We used his phone to call our parents.
So evidently the shooting had started, although you didn't hear it when you were in the cafeteria.
I don't remember. You know, I really don't remember hearing the sound of gunshots as I was running. It felt odd. It felt wrong. It felt like I was going to miss my math test. I mean, all of that was going through my head.
You graduate from high school eventually, and then you go back to make this film. Who did you select, and how did you select the people that you would profile?
Well, I knew I wanted to stick with the freshman class because that's what I knew, and that was my experience. And I started with Amy, I guess, first, because we stayed friends after graduation. And I kind of wanted to do a test interview just to see if, you know, if we could start talking about our experience, because I didn't realize we were together that day until I sat down and talked to her with the camera. And it all came back, and we just got to share that day together. From there, I think I went to Gus next. I mean, it was all organic, these four amazing people. And then also trying to articulate to the participants, you know, what my goal was and what I promised I wouldn't do. You know, I promised I wasn't going to name the shooters. I promised I wouldn't show any cafeteria footage from that day. You know, I was just going to say a lot of people weren't really interested in speaking with me also. you know, it's like we don't need to. We know what the other person is feeling, and we don't need to relive it.
Yeah.
I just felt like we never got to tell our story.
Is that why you made the movie then?
Yeah, it really is. I just, you know, I was determined to make this film about the collective experience of people who were there and not about the crime. And I wanted it to be solely about the kids that went through it and how we've been healing on our own, but also like how we came together to help each other, especially during those 3 years at the school. You know, and at the time I thought, well, maybe I could help future survivors of mass shootings, not knowing that we would have more.
When did you begin making the movie? When did you begin filming?
I started filming in 2012, actually right before Sandy Hook.
And did you imagine it was going to be a process that would take this long?
No. I mean, I knew documentaries, you know, can take as long as they take. You know, you let the story unfold. I think that's one of the beauties of making documentaries is, you know, you have an idea, but sometimes that story can take you somewhere else. You know, a lot of it was also emotional to make the film. You know, it was very personal. So going through archive and stuff, I mean, that was pretty intense. So a lot of it was emotionally driven because of how long it took, but it was also, you know, financial. You know, it's not cheap to make a feature independent film.
Your four classmates agreed to talk to you. A lot of students didn't want to because they just didn't want to maybe relive, at least for a camera, this experience. But your colleagues that did agree would. Did you or had they already received some sort of counseling or therapy after the fact, or was this that?
They did. They received some. I know, you know, some more than others. But I do know that being back in the school was the first time for all of them.
So wait a minute, you took the camera and went back to the school with them during your school day or when the school was empty?
It was empty. We needed, we were allowed, so the school let me come in, which it was rare. I didn't think they were actually going to allow me to do that, but they did, I think because I was, you know, I was an alumni. You know, and I also thought that it was, you know, it was going to be different going back because I, you know, once we graduated, most of us left, and I guess what's the point of returning, especially to that space and to be back at ground zero of that day. It's one thing to share your story on camera, but then to do it where you were is pretty intense.
So is that what you did? Did you walk these students through where they were and had them retell their story?
Yep, in that moment. So we did a sit-down interview, retelling the story, and then walking through the school doing the same thing. Yeah, it's pretty emotionally draining.
Did you worry or have any sense that maybe this isn't a good idea, that this is...
No, I didn't. I thought it may be beneficial, but I quickly realized that, you know, sometimes going back to the things that make you uncomfortable is another way to help you move forward.
Mm-hmm.
But they did it, and they did it with such courage.
Can you tell me one of the stories that they told that you captured in the film?
One of the biggest stories I think that I learned was from Amy, because we were together that day in the cafeteria when she was walking through the school. I took her, or she took us back to where her locker was during those 3 years, and then we started talking about, you know, that there were bombs in the school. I mean, we all knew that, but that there was actually one under our table, Amy and I's table in the cafeteria. I was not aware of that, so that was something that I learned in the moment on camera, and then, you know, you're finding that out, and as I'm, like, interviewing her, it was very emotional for me, too. I mean, we had to take a break, so that was kind of hard. You know, you want to put your director hat on and stay professional, but yet it's so personal.
You talked to the principal of the school at the time, right?
Yes.
I was interested that he was willing to cooperate, too. I mean, maybe he appreciated the effort, but I could see him saying, it was difficult for me then, and I don't need to do that again now.
Frank DeAngelis, he was the rock, I guess, at the school, and he was the one that kept us together and kept us moving forward. And I didn't know, you know, it's one thing to talk to students that were there and freshmen at the time, but you don't think as a kid that these adults are also going through the same thing that we are. You know, they have their moments of terror and triggers, and they're healing as well. I just kept thinking, you know, I still called. I remember the first day of filming, I would call you know, say Mr. D, but he's like, call me Frank, you know, and then Kiki Leyva, I kept calling him Mr. Leyva, and he's like, could you please call me Kiki? So, like, you know, I'm still stuck in that of a position of authority.
When he would come out of the principal's office for the first several weeks, he would burst into tears, or at least start to cry, because of the emotional heft that he was carrying.
So Frank said that in the film, that it was hard for him to walk out of his office, you know, meaning it was hard for us too. And then Kiki clearly had his days in the, you know, some bad days in the classroom, but you're a teacher, you know, where do you go to take your time to, you know, to heal and cope with what's going on?
What was it like when you all went back to school? You then, after the scene was cleared, you all went to school elsewhere for a while. Eventually the school was repaired and you went back. What was it like when you went back to school? What was the contrast?
I think it was a mix of emotions. It was a little scary. I don't think for me personally, in the sense that this could happen again, but it was also with all of us being together was really helpful, at least for my healing. You know, whether we talked about it or not, at least we knew we were together. And everyone was super sensitive and compassionate. You know, like Zach says in the film, you actually ask how you're doing, how's your family doing? Not just, you know, hey, how are you?
Right. When you went back to school, either on that satellite campus or back to the Columbine itself, did academics or, I don't know, academic achievement, athletic achievement, did those things not seem as important then, or did the high school experience feel different then?
It felt different in that everyone was really nice, and we were all, I mean, we were just treating each other with respect and sensitive to one another, you know, not knowing what each person had been through, but just like, hey, if you were there, like, you know, I got you.
Yeah,
Also, we were trying to live, you know, this idea of normal, you know, go back to being a high school kid as much as possible. You know, we still had desires of, you know, competing and representing your team and being part of a team. I mean, I think that was still there for a lot of us.
I asked you at the beginning of this conversation if the senior class felt it differently than the freshman class. Your class at least had to feel it longer than anybody else. You were walking those halls for 4 years, 3+ years after the fact. Nobody else would have been there and been through it as long as you in that way. I mean, to me, this must have been a more...
See, that's hard. I mean, you know, what I've learned is, you know, trying not to compare traumas also, you know, but I'm still curious. I can't imagine being a senior and going through that and then all of a sudden being away from everyone you know that's, you know, that was there that day. I mean, that's got to be tough to just get thrown into college with people that have no understanding of what you've been through and you're just supposed to figure it out. It's like being thrown at the deep end.
You don't dwell in the movie, right, on the violence per se?
Mm-mm.
I know you don't mention the name of the shooter.
Right. It's also, you know, images of violence, you know, in real time and replaying the same images over and over is painful. It is re-traumatizing. And sounds as well, I mean, those are painful to hear. They're triggers for someone that has experienced this trauma. They didn't want to do that.
Well, I think that's a sort of newfound wisdom. I know in the book Parkland, the author does not mention the name of the shooter, nor does he spend but a few pages describing in a sort of mechanical way the shooting at Parkland, and then he goes on to trace the lives of the students afterwards. And he's adamant
right.
that we should not either re-traumatize these people or glorify the act itself. And putting a name on it and describing it in some sort of gory detail does that. So there's no value in that. That's counterproductive, he says. I suppose you would agree.
100%. Absolutely. That was definitely a lesson learned. And I think, you know, we're getting better with that and not, you know, maybe not even focusing on just the headlines.
When people hear the word Columbine, do you share the fact that you were a Columbine at the time? Maybe you do a little bit now because of your work, but growing up since then and at that time, did you kind of not want to advertise that because of what would happen when people heard the word Columbine?
100%. Yeah, I definitely, you know, because I went away to school, so I was meeting people all the time, you know, where are you from? even sometimes what high school did you go to. And I knew early on that as soon as I said Littleton, you know, they kind of look at you cross-eyed, like, how do I know that city? And sometimes I'd remind them, but I never said, oh, I was there. You know, I said, oh, yeah, it's where Columbine is. And then I'd leave it alone.
And your parents, mm-hmm. are they alive and well? And what do they make of what you went through at the time or your work on this film? I always have questions like that. So we'll pause it here. The interview that we were playing just before the news, I should have asked you to back it up about 10 seconds, Elif. Did you? Okay. So this is the final part of Rick Kogan's column in the Chicago Tribune today. That is, he talked to Lori Farber. She has this documentary film about Columbine. She was a student at Columbine. She then came to Chicago and studied documentary filmmaking at Columbia. She then, starting several years ago, was going back to Columbine, interviewing some of her old classmates, colleagues, the principal. She made this documentary film. She lives in Dallas now. It debuts tonight at the Music Box Theater here in Chicago, and I have not seen the movie. Kogan says it is spectacular, and it's something that unfortunately resonates still today. We were talking about the reaction that her parents had, and your parents, mm-hmm. are they alive and well, and what do they make of what you went through at the time or your work on this film?
Yeah, no, they are alive and well. I think they were a little nervous that I'm putting myself out there to, you know, I was able to tell them the purpose of this film and what I was trying to do. And then, you know, once I actually completed the film, I think they definitely understood more how important it was to tell this story and why. Mm-hmm. I'm okay. I'm getting better. And I think this film helped me do that.
I wonder if they see the movie and they say, oh my God, Laura, I didn't know that. Or why didn't you tell me that? Or how are we just finding this out now? Were there revelations like that for your family?
Yeah, I think so. And I also think same for the participants in the film. I talked to a lot of parents, you know, at some of the screenings, and they learned a lot. Because we did, like I said, we just didn't talk. We didn't talk about it. It's not that my, you know, our parents didn't ask. They asked all the time. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, you say I'm fine,
uh-huh.
or you brush it off, or... You know, it's just something that you keep to yourself. And I know, you know, in high school kids tend not to share much anyway, but this was something, and I'm sure it was hard for them as well to, you know, just not knowing and then wondering, you know, is Laura okay? If I tell them I'm okay, I guess, what, you know, where do you go from there?
You know, that's it, Laura. I mean, I had adolescence at that time, and you must appreciate the fact that when you ask a teenager how you're doing, they'll say fine, even though they're mad at their boyfriend, or they're worried about this test, or they're just, you know, their hormones are there, and they don't want to talk. But when a kid goes through
right.
what you all went through, and they say that, how does a parent, what do they do with that? Maybe you're not fine. I'll bet you're not fine. So now what do I do? And if I pester you about it, maybe I make it worse. It's this awful circle, you know?
Yeah, it is, and it's tough. I just know that, I mean, I would never say stop asking, as annoying as it might be for the teenager, just knowing that you're, you know, that you're there and you're supportive
mm-hmm.
goes a long way. You know, they might not tell you, but if you just ask and make sure, and I think all of our parents tried to push some counseling on us because it was available, but if you're not ready, you're not going to go. You know, or you can go, but it's not going to have an impact like it might when you're ready to actually talk to somebody. You know, and that didn't happen until later on in life, you know, for a lot of us as adults. And we were finally ready to say, hey, I can't live like this anymore. And I need to do something about it, talk to someone, get some, you know, some therapy. And there's all kinds of therapy, all, you know, EMDR and tapping. I mean, there's all different stuff.
I wonder if anybody's done a survey of what happens to students who collectively suffer something like that, and then what is their rate of substance abuse or alcoholism or other destructive behaviors because they can't cope. You know, your class, your school would be an interesting case study in that.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of us, you know, did abuse substances of all kinds. You know, sometimes that can be a phase, and sometimes that can take you down a rabbit hole that's not pretty. If you don't take care of yourself, I think that's number one. You know, you got to be selfish there.
Yeah. Do you have a message then, finally, to leave our listeners with? I mean, so based on this film, based on what you reveal or discover, what should we know? Is there a prescription or a bottom line here?
I mean, I just, you know, I think we're getting it now, but, you know, healing just, it's not one size fits all. You know, stop judging and judging yourself, and you can be selfish. And then more importantly, I think what hit home for me through making this film was that, you know, we did the best we could. And I think if we could just remind ourselves, I'm doing the best I can every day, then that's, I mean, that's a great way to cope.
And maybe acknowledge that it will be an everyday. This has become your life, and maybe you'll never get to put it on a shelf and say, okay, fixed that. That this is just going to form you, and it's going to be how you're going to live, and you'll live a happy and productive life, but that will always be part of your experience.
Yeah, part of it and not defining it.
I just finished a book called Spearhead about a tank gunner in World War II who, at the age of 88, goes back to the scene of the battle and is still, you know, processing what happened in his wartime combat. And some of the things that you are talking about sound very much like things a World War II veteran is to this day having to process. Had a great life, but and did not define him, but
right.
It was also something that, you know, was part of his maybe day-to-day experience. And I suppose there's some similarities there, huh?
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. I think any trauma, right?
Yeah.
There's all kinds of trauma. And that was the other thing, was I really wanted to reach trauma survivors of all kinds. I think this film might be able to help people.
That's a good aim, isn't it? And that's Laura Farber. She is the filmmaker who, she's not in town then. Well, yeah, no, she is in town for that. Is she, do you know Laura or Elif going to be at the screening then tonight at the Music Box Theater at 7 o'clock? Music Box Theater at 7 o'clock. I don't know if you can still get tickets to that. You might check that out. It sounds powerful. You can tell I didn't see the movie. Rick Kogan did at the Chicago Tribune and just could not say enough good things about this emotionally potent film, as he describes it, in the Tribune today.